Okay. There's a lot about the beginning of Parshas Va'era. Two in the back, two sheets in the back. A lot about the beginning of Parshas Va'era that's very, very peculiar. Va'era l'Avram al Yitzchak v'el Yaakov v'kel shakai u'shmi Hashem lo nadati v'hotzesi v'yitzalti v'ga'alti v'lakachti v'natati l'chem eretz yisrael morasha. I mean, it's Mikroyam. There's so many beautiful psukim that are so well known. A grand introduction to Geula. But what has changed? Moshe Rabbeinu introduced the notion of Geula and Mitzrayim. These psukim belong at the outset of the narrative. When Moshe approaches Am Yisrael, Hashem should first, two sheets, Hashem should first inform him, Va'ira al Avram al Yitzchak ve'al Yaakov bekel Shakai, he should tell him the four lashonos of Geula. This is really the epic, dramatic start, but it occurs embedded at a later stage of Moshe's mission. So in short, just as a backdrop to tonight's shiur, you remember that Moshe's mission in Parsha Shemos didn't exactly succeed the way we all hoped it would. He was ridiculed and mocked by Paro. All of his signs were duplicated. And not only was that in this week's parsha, but not only was he mocked, but all of his efforts, two sheets, Monty, all of his efforts backfired. Instead of liberating Am Yisrael, he intensified the labor and the persecution. And it wasn't just Paro that scoffed at him, but the Jewish people turned on him. And Moshe Rabbeinu, at a certain point, turns on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak. Lam Hareo Salam Hazeh. So keep in mind the context of Sefer, or Parshas Va'era, in the context of Sefer Shmos. Basically, Geula has ground to a halt. He's been humiliated by Paro, hated by Jewish slaves, and he himself has become pessimistic about the prospects of this Geula, Lamarius. Now that in and of itself is an important lesson. I don't know if we'll have time to speak about it, but at some point I'll slip it in. This is one of Rav Amital's most famous comments, that Geula doesn't have to be linear. It can start, it can lag, it can reverse. And for people living through a non-linear Geula, that's super important. Our prepackaged expectations of Geula are immediate, rapid, apocalyptic, night and day, black and white. What happens in the world around us doesn't accommodate those simplistic views. Does that make it any less redemptive? Or to put it into the jargon you've probably studied in high school, can we continue to say, Reshit Smichat Geulateinu after Asa? That's what you really were talking about. But we'll see. Maybe we will, maybe we won't get to that. But Parshas Va'era is a re-installment. It is a rebooting of Geula. And that's why all these grand psukim appear. Because it isn't just the next stage. Moshe appears and he delivers the information. It had all halted. This was the first crisis in Moshe's career. There was a significant crisis. And now it has to be rebooted. Now it has to be regenerated and revitalized. And still, with all these glorious ideas of Eretz Yisrael, I mean, who isn't enchanted by the four Lashonos of Geula? Their differences, their tonalities, V'hotzeiti, V'hitzalti, V'go'alti, V'lekachti. Still, there's obstinance. So take a look at source 3. Vayidaber Moshe Kain al Bnei Yisrael velo shamu el Moshe mikotzer ruach o me'avodah kasha. So here the reasons for Am Yisrael's disbelief are provided. Very interesting phraseology. Normally we either hear the people listen or don't listen. Here we know why they don't listen or don't heed. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now this is round 3. Round 1 was the initial dispatch. Round 2 was the beginning of Va'era. Now it's round 3. Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe lemor. I want you to instruct Paro. Now Moshe is confused. Line number 4. If the Jews didn't listen to me, how will Paro listen to me? So now there are two problems that Moshe is wrestling with. One is the disbelieving people. Two is the obvious recalcitrant leader, this monarch who won't bend his knee to anyone, who has defied Moshe. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu wraps it all up in one solution.
Line number 4, Vaydaber Hashem el Moshe v'el Aaron, Vayitzaveim el b'nei Yisrael v'el paro melech Mitzrayim v'otzias b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim.
How did that solve? What is new in this pasuk, Vayitzaveim? What's new about this?
So there are dual problems, the disbelief of the people,
kotzer ruach me'avodah kasha,
paro's recalcitrance. Some of that pasuk tries to resolve it. Let's see if we can at least target the problems, maybe some of the solutions, because obviously the solutions run throughout the course of Vayera and Bo, the ensuing narrative, it's not just these two psukim, but there's a problem Moshe's facing, and somehow this pasuk tries to solve the problem. So let's take a look at the Meshech Chachma. We haven't had a chance to study the Meshech Chachma too often. Meshech Chachma was written by, anyone know? Meir Simcha, Meshech, Meir Simcha HaKohen. He was the rabbi in Dvinsk around the turn of the century. One of the great luminaries of the pre-Shoah, that last generation, wasn't subjected to the Shoah, wasn't killed in the Shoah. That generation right before the world came crashing down, right before the entire Jewish world was re-outfitted by the Shoah, and of course, the United Israel. Rav Rin is actually one of the Rebbeim, one of the Bet Rebbeim is actually doing a doctorate on the Meshech Chachma. So he's probably one of the world's leading authorities on Meshech Chachma in terms of knowing the mechanics and how the Sefer was written, the tie-ins and the general themes. The Sefer he wrote on the Rambam, just to fill out your impressions, what Sefer did he write on the Rambam? Or Sameach, very good. Or Meir, his name was Meir, one of the great Svarim on the Rambam, and really, undoubtedly, one of the leading rabbis of his generation. Interestingly enough, Rav Brin showed me a letter. He was invited around the turn of the century to be the rabbi in Yerushalayim. And the people of Dvinsk were appalled. How dare you attract Rabbi Meir Simcha Cohen from the great city of Dvinsk? I don't know how many Jews there were, 50,000, maybe 100,000, maybe 150, I don't know a history. How dare you try to tempt him to come to Jerusalem where there's a few smelly Jews? Or be like, oh, you have the greatest position in the world and you're going to, I don't want to insult anyone. You're going there. You're the chief rabbi of Israel, to invert it. And you're going to go off to become the chief rabbi of Slovenia or something? I hope he's not listening. Nothing wrong with Slovenia. Just to show you how unexpected history. People living 100 years ago, that's not too long ago, it's your grandparents, or your grandparents' parents, your great-grandparents, couldn't imagine a esteemed, prestigious rabbi from Vince being invited to be the rabbi. You know how people would kill today to be the rabbi of Yerushalayim? Actually, Rabbi Yerushalayim, the chief rabbi? And where's Dvinsk? So, I know you're all in this home. I know it's hard to be away. It's the dog days of winter. This is where history is evolving. However impressive your homes feel and seem, and they're important to be impressive, it's all a mirage. And believe me, in 100 years, people will speak about, without pointing out names here, will speak about the homes you were part of, and the communities, and the colleges that you enshrine. Oh yeah, historically, as impressive as they all seem. They're all transient. So this is where history is establishing itself with permanence. So enjoy your time here with a front row seat to the conclusion of history. So Rabbein Simcha Cohen in the Meshech Chachma, he takes the simple approach. The simple approach is, I talked about this morning, those of you who came to the Post Shachris, a little plug for the Wednesday Post Shachris Chassidus. The basic shot is, the Ramban follows this as well. It's free advertising. The Ramban follows this as well. The simple, simple shot. I'll make a bracha chrona before I forget. V'lo shamu el Moshe mikotzer ruach ha'mevodah kasha. These are slaves. They're browbeaten into submission. They're persecuted. They are, as we would say, in survival mode. Just getting, remember the last time you were in survival mode? I know sometimes when I'm exhausted, I'm sick, just basically just taking whatever I can, dedicating all my physical resources and strength just to make it through and to attend to all my duties and responses. I don't have that imaginative breath to develop new ideas, to be creative in a sigya, to think about tomorrow, to plan. Sometimes it happens when we have to plan too far in advance, and I don't have that field of vision because I'm just so overwhelmed with physical infirmity and too many things on my plate, I simply can't. I say, it's just too far. I can't deal with it. So these are slaves. And for slaves, just to make it to the end of the day without being whipped or beaten or persecuted or raped or imprisoned or incarcerated, it takes all of their resources. So of course they can't listen to long-term visions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's redemption and Geula and becoming a nation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's read the Meshech Chachma. Source number base, part 3. Mikotze Ruach HaMibadah Kasha. Ki derech kishaye yom. It's an important phrase, circle that phrase. Kishaye yom. Your day is difficult, your day is challenged. Kishaye yom. It's an interesting phrase. Ki derech kishiyom, kishaye yom. Asher yachpotzu lishmoa rak kidei latzeis mitzarasam. V'lo lishmoa behaftachos asidos v'hatzlachos niflos. All these grand visions about the future and hope and epic opportunities to be HaKadosh Baruch Hu's people. They don't have the process. They don't have the sanity. They don't have the inner tranquility to even process those. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognizes this, as sad as it is, as tragic as it is, and he addresses it. Lachain, Vaydaber Hashem al Moshe v'Aaron, that last pasuk that tries to solve this. If you look at that last pasuk, all of a sudden, all those visions get ratcheted down. Instead of describing four lashonas of Gula, instead of describing Eretz Yisrael, what does the pasuk describe? Lehotzi es b'nei Yisrael, last line of source base, me'eretz Mitzrayim. Kelomar, ledaber rak odos hazeh. Don't talk to them about vo'tzeiti, v'yitzalti, v'ga'alti, ge'ula, v'lakachti. Just talk about liberty. Just talk about freedom. Lehotzi es b'nei Yisrael, concretize it, make it immediate, make it simple, keep it simple. Lehotzi es b'nei Yisrael, me'eretz Mitzrayim. So Rav Shmuel is aware of their limited imagination. And he tries to concretize it in the present. And what's on display here? What's on display here is a crucial and delicate balance in life. Not just for slaves. I don't believe any of you will ever be slaves in this room. So what's the takeaway? What's the connotation for people who will ever be enslaved? Well, you may not be enslaved, but I imagine you will all, for most of your adult life, I hope, be at the precipice of Kotzei Ruach Mevodah Kasha. Welcome to the world of modernity. Because the world of modernity has replaced faced tyrants, tyrants with faces, with faceless tyranny. There's no pyro anymore. There's no evil monarch who's imposing his totalitarian will on his innocent and vulnerable subjects. But sometimes the faceless tyrant is more merciless than the human tyrant. Look at how frenzied your world has become. Look at how busy people have become. And a busy schedule is our homage to servitude. We make believe that we lead fulfilling lives because if our schedule is busy, we must have fulfillment. But a full schedule doesn't deliver meaning. If anything, sometimes it wars against meaning and content because you're so busy you don't have the time to think for content and certainly long-term content. So when the Meshech Chachma 120 years ago talked about Kishi Yom, he was referring to actual slaves. But I don't imagine he knew how prophetic his statement was for 2015 for Kishi Yom. When I was in high school, I think, or maybe in college, there was a movie that was meant to capture the cultural ethos of that generation. It was about women in the workplace and women finding a place for themselves, gender relationships in the workplace. I'm not interested in that aspect of the movie, but the title was very, very intriguing. The title was 9 to 5. That was a title, a generic phrase for the workplace. And it starred several assertive women trying to assert female space in the workplace without being molested or discriminated or no gender discrimination. 9 to 5? You don't even know what that refers to. Maybe you do. As an elusive job that none of you will ever pursue. 9 to 5? Who works 9? Do you know anyone that works 9 to 5? Who literally punches the clock at 5 o'clock and walks home? The nature of success in today's workplace. When I say success, I don't just mean success in your actual profession, but in your community, in your lives. Think about how the cliched languages have totally altered our reality. 9 to 5 has been replaced by, what's today's phrase? 24/7. It's a simple shift in vernacular and in terminology, but it's a complete seismic shift the way people experience. People get easier segments. It's 9 to 5, and then I've got, presumably, 12, 13, 14 hours to recuperate and to expend my energy elsewhere. 5 o'clock I'm out, and I'm back the next day at 9. So I've got from 5 in the evening till 7, 8 o'clock, and then I have to make my way to work again. Let's say the work day starts at 8, and we have to start traveling to work. And all of a sudden, work, the irony is that work has veered well beyond any definitive boundaries. We thought that we were diminishing the toll of work by introducing convenience, by allowing menial labor to be performed by machines, no more washing machine, but all of a sudden, that has just created greater financial challenge to keep up with the financial expectations, and those financial expectations have gyrated well beyond schedule. So not only will be slaves, but you'll all be facing a greater tyrant. And there are so many, and to me, this is something I'll never forget because this was Rav Amital's final message. It was at the dinner right before Pesach in America, and Rav Amital had been out of yeshiva for a couple of months because he was very ill the last year. Hardly was in yeshiva. So they videotaped him in his home, and he delivered a message pre-Pesach to all the alumni who had gathered, 500-600 had gathered in New York. His message basically was, pre-Pesach, the modern-day paro is being subjected to professional challenges and ignoring your family. So obviously that's the primary one. How many people here will have the guts to take a cut in your salary, perhaps, or in the prestige that comes with it, sometimes is more important than salary, and recognize not just the equal importance, but the surpassing importance of investing in your family, of investing in family relationships, where again, you're not heralded. It's the workplace that confers title and prestige, and people look up to you, and your accomplishments, and awards, and in the and your family, like I've told you so often, you're just the shmagegi. That's your nickname in the family. Take out the trash and do the diapers and, you know, listen to everyone vent and try to keep up with everyone and serve them. It's no wonder that, obviously, one arena is more attractive, the arena that celebrates you and claps for you and applauds, and the other arena is forsaken. It's no miracle. You have to have a strong inner sense that that's where I primarily invest. But another challenge, less important than the family challenge of the frenzied workplaces, do you have any sense of long-term vision? Do you know where this entire ship is heading? So often it's just the unexamined religious life that so many people are locked into. I don't have time to examine it. I'm so busy. I'm such a ksheyom. I can't think about what's your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu? When are you moving to Israel? What's your relationship with the land of Israel? What's your relationship with religion? Are you careful? It's become such a frenzied, overwhelming swirl of responsibilities. I spoke to the YU alumni 2 weeks ago, I think it was. 2 weeks ago tonight, they had in YU something called Cholent and Chizah. So every 12 o'clock they gather, the Gush guys gather. So this Thursday night, was it Thursday night?
We have the Thursday night as well.
Right, so it was Thursday night. But they have it there also. It was Thursday night, they had to go take an early flight the next morning, so they bumped it back to 11 o'clock. I tell them, that's really the great challenge of college. And by the way, that is the overwhelming challenge of college. That's the one challenge of college, that whether you have a base medrash resource environment or not, it's just overwhelming. Because think about how much effort you're expending here just to keep up and keep your schedule and find time to learn. And all of a sudden, when you don't have a schedule or society supporting it, and you've got double to triple the amount of pressures on your mind, well-intending, good people. I'm not talking about the boy who returns from yeshiva and decides not to learn because he doesn't want any more of it. I'm talking about the well-intending boy who even has resources available, just becomes simply chasing your tail. So it makes this year so unique that you don't have all those distractions and you don't have all those pressures, legitimate ones that you'll face the rest of your life, and you'll have to learn to multitask and carve out significant time. Just where is this heading? What's my relationship with that Kodesh Baruch Hu like? What are my tefillos like? How's my shmiras and mitzvos? As well as other parts of your life that aren't defined in ritual terms. And I actually encourage the boys 2 weeks ago, find spaces in your life that you can tether to vision adjustment. So I know, for example, when I say Boi Vishala Materes Bala Gam Misimcho Vitsala Tochemuni Am Segula, so Boi Vishalam, we treat Shabbos as a Kala. So we're asking Shabbos Kala to come and we're the Baal, we're the husbands. So I try to think every Friday night, how am I doing as a husband? How am I doing as a father? It's a good time for me to remember. I've got to check myself. Am I a good parent? Am I a good husband? Sometimes I get a better mark, sometimes I get a worse mark. But I know that's like an activating signal. Something goes off in my mind. So I told the boys in YU, I want you to walk out of Chalent and Chizuk every Thursday night and just ask yourself, What am I going to improve next week about my avodas Hashem? Whatever it is. It could be kibud av v'aim, it could be chesed, it could be talmud Torah, it could be... Just create, unfortunately, create like these little reminders for yourself. It's like you set a reminder on your phone so you shouldn't forget. Create a little reminder. Oh, when I say every day, v'chofes itzreinu lishtabed lach, every morning, v'chofes itzreinu lishtabed lach, what have I done in the past 24 hours, in the past 2 weeks, that I've been kofes yetzreinu? What have I done to submit my yetzer? What have I done to suppress? What have I had a yetzer for? I stayed up a little later. I didn't say something sarcastic to someone. I didn't look at something I shouldn't have looked at. I wasn't about it. What is it? When have I? Because we define religion sometimes in ways that accommodate human luxury and don't necessarily challenge us to abdicate some of that human luxury. And kfifas leyetzer is part of that. So what have you done? The chofetz is jainu l'shtabelach. I was speaking to a boy a few days ago about getting up for minyan, for the yeshiva minyan. So it's a whole long discussion. I'm sure you know how important we feel it is. And those who aren't yet fully successful, it really, really is. It's a very, very dangerous precipice not to come to the Shiva Minyan on many, many fronts. But we went through all the issues, issue A, issue B, a very respectful conversation, wasn't it? This was a boy who was making a calculation. Well, if I stay up a little later at night, then I dive in a little later Minyan, whatever. I just said, okay, just be honest with yourself. Because generally, not always, those boys who are getting up for Yeshiva Minyan, it's hard. You're tired. 6:30 is not an easy time to get up. You've all been there. That's a moment of kofes itzreinu l'shtabelach. That's a moment we have to say, I'm getting up because I'm an Oved Hashem. As an Oved Hashem, I'm expending effort and mental energy and emotional strength to do something for Avodas Hashem. And getting up at 7:30 is not that hard. It's not as hard as getting up at 6:30. So if you're the boy who's literally pushing himself to his last shred of energy at night to learn Torah, and that, because of that, he's not coming to the yeshiva minyan. Okay, there are other issues to talk about. Whether I don't feel that's the correct decision. We talked about those issues. But it is feasible that if you're just making excuses for yourself and staying up till the, let's say, staying up to learn, you're just being more leisurely. And that's a fail. You shouldn't be leisurely during your year or two in yeshiva, and certainly not in life about Avodas Hashem. Avodas Hashem is not leisure. Avodas Hashem is work in the true nature. And we've looking seen symbolize and demonstrate it. That's what this was written on his tomb, of Oved Hashem. He just wanted to be an Oved Hashem. So, like I told you, someone so sophisticated and educated and scholarly didn't allow us to acquit ourselves from work. Oh, working in religion, those are the other people. But no. If you saw Rav Aaron work in religion and run to davening and say Yehi Shmei Rabba and scream the Haftarah, you realize that religion isn't just defined as ideas and theories and fancy books and articles. It's just defined as Avodas Hashem. So try to create this balance between the kotzer ruach, where you just are so busy, not as a slave, but as a slave to this faceless routine that accelerates so rapidly and so quickly, and try to make sure that you can concretize Avodas Hashem. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is doing. Evidently, the Jewish people aren't at this stage ready for those grand visions. So he says, you know, just tell them about leaving Mitzrayim. Tell them about immediate liberation, immediate emancipation. That's something they can digest. That's something they can consume at this stage. And then I'll slowly introduce broader narrative notions. There's a scene I didn't get a chance to fully describe that I'm now describing to you back in Parshas Toldos. And let's read that scene, because I remember Parshas Toldos, we got derailed speaking about Yitzchak as a post-revolutionary institutionalist. So let's think about what I just described, but through the lens in your supplementary Mekaros of Esav. Because what I just described to you is the pretext to Esav's great abdication of vision. Because Esav makes Esav commits the greatest folly in history. This is a little shout out to the Americans and especially to the New Yorkers. I apologize to the non-Americans, the non-New Yorkers, as if they're anything outside of New York. But one of the greatest tragedies, right, was the sale of Manhattan. Who knows how much was Manhattan? 27 trinkets? 24 trinkets. Thank you, Yosef, for that random fact. 24 trinkets for the island of Manhattan. I bet the engines could wish they could have that one back. Mekachtos. Some of the guys in my shul were learning Mekachtos in Bava Basra Tzadik Beis. Wish they felt we paskin like Rav. Not like Shmuel. Mekachtos. Well, it was a greater tragedy, greater folly. And that was Esav's exchange of the Bechar. One day Manhattan will also be a wilderness, will also be a jungle. But to be selected for history, that's timeless and priceless. Talk about your 24 trinkets. Esav exchanges Bechorah and historical destiny for a plate of beans. for some shakshuka. Now you realize how terrible trade is. Melos and beans, but shakshuka. You can give it away. So are there sperm night on shakshuka, I imagine? There are copious amounts of sperm, shakshuka night. Okay, I've been there, guys, trust me. This is what we don't tell boys when we recruit them to Gush. Oh, the food is great. Shakshuka. So Esav walks in, Vayazed Yaakov Nazir, Vayavo Esav min ha-sada. This is a man who is a man of the field, Ish Sadeh. He's just tired. I don't think he's tired in a physical sense. That doesn't account for his malfunctional decision. He's just too busy. Too many traps to set. Too many animals to hunt. Too many nets to throw. Too many rivals to outflank. His mind is whizzing. He can't keep up with himself. That's why he relates to the food, not as food, it's just a swirl of color. Vayomer Esav al Yaakov haliteni na min ha'adom, ha'adom hazeh. Ki ayef anochi. Listen to the repetition of ayef. Ki ayef anochi. For it's just a swirl of red. Give me some meat. What do you want to order? I don't care. Just slap on some meat. Slap on some red. Doesn't have to be meat. Just make it red. He's not a vegan. What a tragedy. Going to a restaurant, you don't have the dignity to choose to... Such an undignified eating has to be accompanied by some level of dignity. And it should express itself in the pace that you eat, and the way you eat, the table manners, and the company you keep. One night, a long, long time ago, let's go back around 10, 12 years ago, I came back from a day of testing... It's, I think, 2 or 3 schools. I hadn't eaten. None of the Bachrim who were in my shir at that time had told their friends to bring me Dunkin' Donuts. I don't know, maybe this year's boys will be a little bit more attentive. So I hadn't eaten the whole day. And I came back to where I was staying with my parents. It was close to 12 o'clock at night. So I went into what was at a fast food restaurant that has since closed called Kosher Delight. It was open all night. I walked in, I ordered my food, I sat down at the table. To tell you it resembled the bar scene from Star Wars is an understatement. Who is sitting in Kosher Delight at 12 o'clock at night? Not families. No one was eating with dignity. It was literally out of Star Wars. I sat there eating. I don't want to tell you how people were sitting. I don't want to tell you they were conducting themselves, how they were putting food down their hatches. At a certain point, I just folded my hamburger. I hadn't eaten all day. I remember tossing it in the garbage, saying, my nobility is more important than my stomach. I refuse to eat here. I just went home, went to sleep, and started again the next day. And I realized that at that point, there was a contest between the two. And if I put another bite in my stomach, I'd feel ill in my mind and in my spirit. I'd rather go to bed hungry. I'd rather go to bed hungry. Because it's not just about food. And Esav was in that bar scene, or was in that... Haliteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh k'yefanofi. It's just... Phrase of not even eating. It's like tanking up. Halitanium is essentially stopping at the gas station. Stopping at the gas station to fill up your car is not an act of mobility. It's a necessity. You just fill it up. You open the window. You should be courteous to the attendant. Self-serve. I always go to the self-serve lane, a little cheaper. So if you go to the full service lane, be attentive. Please fill it up. There's no deeper meaning. There's no deeper experience. Phrase of eating is like filling up at the gas tank. That's why it's called Edom, because of the swirl of red. So Yaakov comes and says, well, this is my opportunity. And Esav says, what does this have to do with my life? Bechora? Why is this important? Long-term service, long-term glory, the majesty of serving the Beis HaMikdash. I'm going to die. I can't cast my vision beyond. Vayakam vayesh vayacha vayelch. So the only time in Tanakh there are 5 verbs in a row. Look at the last 5 words on the page. Vayachal, vayesh, vayakam, vayelech, vayibes. As if you're missing the point, Esav is a man of action. So he's only described with verbs. No qualifiers or nouns or prepositions or other sentient structures. And in this great, great effort and labor, he loses his vision and he forfeits his bechorah. Vayibes Esav is a bechorah. So if our parsha describes slaves who are persecuted into the abdication of vision, Esav is someone who self-abdicates because he's just so busy. And sadly enough, you're all closer to Esav's peril than you are to the Bnei Yisrael and Mitzrayim. Because no one will be whipped or flogged or persecuted or enslaved, but you will be Ish Sadeh, I assume. And how does the Ish Sadeh maintain not Kishay Ruach, but Orech Ruach? Orech Ruach for long-term questions that are absolutely vital. And the longer you delay them in life, the longer you ignore them, the more haunting they'll become. Don't think you can ignore questions of identity. When you ignore questions of identity, you just become more and more hollow. And what seems easy becomes difficult, and what seems difficult becomes easy. Sometimes people say, it's easier for me right now not to have to think about it. Yeah, maybe easier in the short term, but generally, easy in the short term is more difficult in the long term. So the sooner that you embrace those challenges and you make even small dosages of improvements, small changes, the easier it becomes. So this is the Meshech Chachma's view. Avelo Shamu El Moshe Mikotzer Ruach U'me'avodah Kasha. They were Kishei Ruach. They couldn't swallow long-term vision. And to a degree, HaKadosh Baruch Hu compromises for them and accommodates them and provides immediate, concrete, and so much of it, as I told you, is on the one hand maintaining that long-term vision, but also making concrete steps that are staying. You're not going to change your whole life just because every week when you're singing Ka'echsof, or every week when you say Boi V'Shalom, or every week when you go to Chalant and Chizuk, or every day when you say V'Chofes Yitzreinu, or whatever. Something just popped into my head. Very interesting, very interesting. When I interview boys, so one of the questions I ask on an interview for acceptance into yeshiva is, what's your favorite mitzvah? Okay, it's an open-ended question just to see what type of religious inner life the boy has, the boy possesses. Okay, you get the standard ones. One boy told me that his favorite mitzvah is tzitzis. Why is it tzitzis? He tells me he remembers holding onto those strings in Auschwitz and how much of a relief it felt holding onto something that had, I don't know if he said it this way, but transgenerational sustainability. That outside of Auschwitz, it was, he didn't say that word. That was my interpretation. I felt it was such a deep answer, such a deep sense. So think about these. It's again, sometimes when you try to hit the high notes and you try to be complex about religion, you sometimes run the risk of not making it concrete enough. So that's what religion's about, holding onto your tzitzis. It has to be more sophisticated, more elegant, more complex, more subtle. But the great risk of complexity and subtle ideas is that they're so impalpable that they fade. They're not compelling, a gas. These random particles moving in absolute random accelerated pace, but it pays a price for that, but it's impalpable, imperceptible. So much of Avodas Hashem is that balance between the conceptual, sophisticated, complex ideas and day-to-day routine that you latch onto. Think about how powerful dress is for the Haredi community, for the Hasidic community. We sometimes scoff at dress. It doesn't make a difference what's on the outside. It makes a difference what's on the inside. Well, how successful are they? How successful are we in terms of average? Again, don't glorify it. A very interesting story, just because I come back with a lot of stories. I have to unload on you guys. I was on a plane, Matzei Shabbos, from Florida to New York City. It was meant to land at 12, but landed at 1. There's a guy next to me, you know, some tall guy, some tall dude, sitting next to me, listening, playing on his iPad, whatever. And they're doing my work. And as the plane lands, he says, where are you going? You know, he actually asked me, you going to Brooklyn? A big kippah on my head, black kippah. Said, yeah. He says, can I have a ride with you? That's where all the Jews live in New York. Can I have a ride with you? He says, sure. At first I asked him, what's your name? Obviously, since you just invited to get into my car. He says, his name is Shia. I said, great, you can have a ride with me. I charged him. They can have a ride with me. So it was a real sprint to get, because I really need to get to sleep. So I ran to the rental car, he helped me with the rental car. So I realized that he was, you know, on the up and up. He was always carrying my bag for me. It's like, division of labor. You run, you get, I'll get the car. And we're driving home. It turns out he's a former Satmar Chassid who fell out of Satmar and spent 6 years in Berkeley, or as I call it, Berserkly, I don't know, somewhere in Northern California, doing all sorts of things, basically betraying, rebelling, against the system. And he was describing a very high level of people that fall out of what he described. Obviously, he had his own commentary and his own, he was very jaded perception. But certainly from his jaded perspective, the repression and the sexual repression. And he described in very, very bleak and oppressive terms, and he described a very high fallout rate. And it may be. And then those people fall, they may fall very far. Evidently, since there's really only one formula for success in that community, the fall is not just a fall from religion, it could be a fall from society and from community and from successful professional pursuits. Maybe our falls are more protected, but what rate do we average a fall? What rate do they average a fall? I don't know. I don't know the statistics. I don't know if anyone's done a study. So you can't base on anecdotal evidence a guy made on a plane. It's not going to be reflective of larger communities. But dress and cultural coding is a very, very powerful and compelling physical container. And sometimes we scoff at that. And maybe you should. I think back now to a Talmud of mine, who Baruch Hashem today is a very successful doctor, he's married, has children, he's a Ben Torah. Very person, a lot of creative energies. Tremendous authored a novel, went for smicha, medical school. Person that had many different expressions as Avodas Hashem. And he went, if I'm not mistaken, he went to Columbia. This goes back a good 20 years. And he came to Columbia University and said, Rabbi, maybe in Columbia I should dress every day with a white shirt and black pants, or maybe tzitzis. I forget what he said. In a way that he wasn't accustomed to dressing in yeshiva. And I said, well, why? Why? He says, because now that I'm in Columbia, I fear that the lines between Kodesh and Chol, between culturally safe havens and culturally, or religiously safe, those dangerous havens will be blurred. At least if I dress a certain way, it's clear to me and clear to a degree to my surroundings that I'm part of your group, I'm part of this university, but I'm also not part of it in a way that leaves no point, leaves no room for questions. Leaves no rooms for questions. It's a very wise idea for this person. I think that person, I could argue, was far more successful than it would have otherwise been with people always constantly checking those boundaries and sometimes blurring those boundaries. And those who are in very, very non-religious settings, you can probably attest to that. I've been there in the past, and I've from college, and the people that are returning. It may be very, very healthy to create those boundaries. Again, as discordant as it sounds with our general view of synthesis and integration and everything is good enough, maybe you have to sometimes be more discordant and abrasive and create red lines and boundaries. Anyway, that's the approach of the Meshech Chachma. Let's take a look at the approach of, Medrash. We'll get back to some of the other stuff. Let's take a look at the Medrash on the bottom of page 2. It's on the back of page 2. It starts the number, but it's really on the back page. Vayidaber Moshe Kein El B'nei Yisrael, V'lo Shamu El Moshe, Mikotze Ruach Mevada Kasha. Hayakasha b'yenehem lifrosh me'avodazar. The difficulty is me'avodah kasha. Here the Medrash is playing on the word avodah kasha. It's not the hard labor, but the world of paganism in which they were immersed. In Parsha Shmos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe had spoken of liberty and freedom. Oh, that everyone can accept. But now in Parshas Va'era, it becomes religious in tonality. That means responsibilities and mitzvot. Now all of a sudden, they clung to the world of Avodah Zarah. Now in 2015, that seems odd. Why would a person be fearful about exiting the world of paganism and becoming a Jew, or for that matter, Lahavdil, any other monotheist, a Christian or a Muslim? Well, let's face it, pure monotheism, and Judaism is pure monotheism, is very difficult, it's very challenging. Paganism provides a security blanket. Taking God and making him palpable, taking God and subjecting him to human terms, basically paganism is any and every attempt to humanize God, to make him more discernible, make him more human. What does it mean to live your entire life with a God you'll never see or prove or be able to describe? That's why in our empirical world, so many people are suffering crisis of faith, because they're using a certain set of tools and methodology to try to discover religion. I just don't think it exists. Maybe others would argue. I don't think positivist logic can uncover HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our world. There are too many other strategies to explain the phenomenon in our reality. And religion is... Shh. Religion is premised on traditions that are delivered from parents to children, from rebbes to talmidim. It's an instinct. It's not something you can prove. And you'll have more questions than answers. I live with questions. Or Amital in this room will tell us all the time, religion and Rav Aaron is about living with questions. You uncover some answers. You live with other questions. I just spoke in the beginning of this week, even going through the Holocaust, which again, so much of Holocaust thought has been usurped by redemptive State of Israel thought. But that generation that lived through the Holocaust, it had a lot of questions. So in the beginning of the week, and Rav Amital wrote about how you can no longer, like Rabbeinu Bachya said, and this is a very brave and brazen statement of Rav Amital, Rabbeinu Bachya, the Talmud of the Ramban, said that all of religion could be pivoted on Hakaras HaTov, on gratitude. I spoke earlier this week after Shacharis about gratitude. If you're just grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then you'll realize Him as a supreme being, and you'll... Rav Amital said, evidently after the Shoah, that's no longer the pivot for many people. How could Am Yisrael build their religious fabric with HaKadosh Baruch Hu based on gratitude? You're grateful for the Shoah. I think on a personal level, our lives have been improved to the point that we can feel grateful. We think we're grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because Baruch Hashem, we've recovered so magnificently and accelerated that we're grateful. Look at the lives you've lived. Baruch Hashem, you've been raised in comfort. Baruch Hashem, you're healthy. Baruch Hashem, you live in societies that support your liberties and your freedoms. It's on a personal level. But in terms of Am Yisrael, we're still recoiling from the Holocaust and the challenges of being in Eretz Yisrael. So I think we have recovered some of that gratitude, but certainly for that post-Holocaust generation, it's very hard to build the entire interface with HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the trait of gratitude. It's very difficult. And he suggested a different way, faith and loyalty and commitment, even through death and even through sacrifice and even through martyrdom. That can create a greater bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But monotheism is a tough ride. It's tough. It's difficult. Not just to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but to feel passion. Getting up in the morning at 6:30 is not about belief, but it's about being able to generate a certain drive and commitment level and passion about an object you'll never see or imagine. Generally, the objects of our passion are physical. Very often boys come over to me now at this stage of the year and say, Rebbe, I don't yet feel passionate about learning or about religion. What should I do? So my first question always is, and if you're feeling this, it's important to hear it, what do you feel passionate about? Very often the answer is sports or food. So evidently it's not a problem with religion, it's just emotional maturity. What are you passionate about? Just understanding what passion is, being able to generate it and embed it in your identity. Passion is about being committed to something so holy, as we would say in our modern time, being all in beyond yourself, and you're willing to sacrifice and endure hardships for that. Marriage is very hard. You endure hardships at all levels, emotional, financial, schedule. It's not all peaches and cream, as you know, and you probably have seen. I'm sure your parents have beautiful marriages. But you're passionate about the institution of marriage, about the woman in particular, so you're willing to sacrifice your own personal liberties and comforts and time and whatever, because I'm passionate about Eretz Yisrael. Not all glorious. It's a struggle to live here at a certain level. I don't feel it anymore, but I'm passionate about Talmud Torah. So what ideas are you passionate about? If you take a look, I know I'm jumping from page to page. If you take a look at the last source in your supplementary Makaros, not the last source, it's source number two. Hashem introduces Himself to Moshe, Vayira El Avraham El Yitzhak on the supplementary page, El Yaakov, Bekel Shakai, Ushni Hashem Lo Nodati Lahem. That's a strange sentence grammar. Ushni Hashem, it should be, Vayira El Avraham El Yitzhak Bekel Shakai, VeHashem Lo Nodati Lahem. What is Ushni Hashem? So many, it's a very, very theological, metaphysical pasuk. There's a lot of depth there in the Rishonim. What's the difference between Shakai and Yud Kei Vav Kei? You can look at the Ramban, at the Ibn Ezra. This is a very important theological section about the way we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But this Medrash is not about theology. It's about passion and mission. By HaKadosh Baruch Hu placing the word Shni before Yud Kei Vav Kei, He sets an example. Look at source 2. Harishayim Kodmin Lishmam. Rishayim come before their name. Whenever a Rasha is introduced in the text, Naval Shemo. Naval is his name. Golias Shemo. Golias is his name. So the proper noun comes before the, and it's not really a generic noun, the pronoun, but the name. So Golias Shemo. Naval Shemo. Sheva ben Bichri Shemo. Aval Asadikim, line number 3, Shemam Kodmin. The word shame precedes their pronoun. Ushmo Elkanah. Ushmo Yishai. Ushmo Boaz. Ushmo Mordechai. Ushmi Hashem. So Hashem sets this template. Shame Hashem. Ushmi Hashem. This seems very arbitrary, even idiosyncratic. What's the difference between Naval Shemo or Shmo Elkanah, Shmo Yishai? Well, every person in life has themselves and hopefully has some mission that they live for beyond themselves. And certainly in Tanakh, names aren't just random, but names reflect mission. Ki min hamayim mishisihu. Yaakov, all the names so far of great people, all are reflective of great mission, predictors of great mission. So part of the struggle in life is what comes first, you or your mission, you or your name. What do you live for? Do you live for the you? Well, the you needs to eat, and the you needs to have fun, and the you needs to make money, and the you needs to have other services or other needs serviced. They can be psychological. They could be emotional. They could be communal. Or is it, I have a mission in life. Now, to serve my mission, I have to make sure my emotional needs are served. I'm a healthy person. I'm healthy. I've said this phrase to you so often. What do you live for beyond yourself? If you can't answer that question, you're not leading an idealistic life. It doesn't have to be grandiose. I'm living to solve cancer and to, you know, create world peace. But it has to be, and of course for a religious person, it has to be, well, first and foremost, I live for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, beyond myself. Even if the self has to be sacrificed for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We talked about this in the Old City Shabbat. But obviously that should cascade into a whole range of values. Part of being an Oved Hashem is I live for, fill in the blanks, Talmud Torah, Am Yisrael, Chesed, Shmiras HaMitzvahs, family. I don't live just to make ends meet, prosper, get the next level of study. Live Ushmi Hashem, Ushmo Elkanah, Ushmo Yishai. That's what idealism is defined as. Not the you. Now the you has to survive in order that there should be a delivery. If there's no you, there's nothing to deliver. The you will just self-annihilate. But the you has to be profound and nourished and replenished, but can't be the you as the end. The you is just the means. Are you an end or are you a means? Some point you have to service the you as an end so that it can continue to be a means. So avodah zara is easier than monotheism. Because monotheism is abstract. Monotheism isn't empirical, isn't concrete. And avodah zara is not just palpable, but is also human powered. When avodah zara is masa yidei adam, it's not just describing the manufacturing process, it's describing the intellectual experience. It's self-contained, it's human-sized. If God is a fish, then I can wrap my head around that. If God is a tree, I can touch it. If God is a physical human being, well, I can wear him around my neck and embed him in a painting and curse with his name. Oh, Jesus. It creates human control. It's not just human dimensions, but it's human control. Ma'aseh yidei Adam. That's a security blanket. What does it mean to stare into the great abyss and believe in a being you'll never know or be able to imagine? That takes incredible courage, incredible emotional courage. And the Jews were wary of that. Let us remain. This avodas Hashem is kasha. I'd rather have avodah kala. We'd rather choose the ancient pagan idolatry of Egypt with the magic and the statues and the reptile gods and the virgin gods. And they're easier. So if religion is difficult, not just in practice, although it's difficult in practice also, that's part of what happened, is that now they were told about mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael, whereas in Shmos they were referred to as free men. And how do you cast religion as both emancipating and liberating, even though in a day-to-day it's obligatory and mandating? And religion is to lead us on in life. Every minute of your life, you have a chiyuv. If you're not doing something productive, you should be learning Torah. And the Gemara says that Reishis Dino Shel Adam Al Talmud Torah, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu will call you to judgment. And then there's no elusiveness, there's no excuses. Le'asid Lavo, there's no excuse making, and now I could have and should have. The Asad Lava HaKadosh Baruch Hu uncovers truth. And it doesn't have to, because the encounter with the HaKadosh Baruch Hu dispossesses you of self-delusion. Sometimes you're just looking at truth so clearly, you're dispossessed of self-justification. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu will ask you, what happened to Talmud Torah? And if you can account for every single minute in a productive fashion, then again, with Talmud Torah incorporated, because every Jew, every male Jew has to learn Torah, What about all the unaccounted moments where we just are too intoxicated with freedom to actually answer the call of duty and to perform those duties? So part of it was a transition from religion as described by freedom to religion as described by mandate and summons. Avodah kasha. Part of it was not just the practical avodah kasha of performing mitzvahs, but it was simply the theological avodah kasha. I think a lot of people today are stuck in the avodah kasha of abstract theological challenge. It's hard for people in such a material world to believe, or to believe deeply in HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he is impalpable or concrete. And that's why so many people are getting challenged religiously. And I've noticed it as an educator, both here in the yeshiva as well as in the broader equation, in the broader world. And if there's one thing you can endow to your children that you should set your sights on now that you're 17 or 18 or 19, is the solution to that problem is you as a parent. That is the most proven form of religious stability and sustainability, is to have a father and a mother who are b'nei Tara and b'nos Tara, who are committed to Avodas Hashem, who raise a healthy family and are healthy role models. Sadly enough, most, I haven't conducted a study, I haven't really delved into this from a scientific standpoint, but just anecdotally, most of the young men and women I've met who are struggling, not all, but most of the young men and women I've met who are struggling theologically is because this was absent. They just didn't have healthy role models. Either the parents weren't religiously committed, or they were, but unfortunately in terms of the parenting dynamic or the family dynamic, again, I don't want anyone to take this as a just anecdotal. So if you provide that solution, you provide that connector to the Masorah for your children by building a beautiful marriage and being a beacon as a role model who takes mitzvah seriously and doesn't talk during davening and comes to davening on time and davens properly and learns Torah and is a member of the community, you're a hero. You're reconstituting a Masorah in an environment in which people don't have those connectors freely available. And that's heroism. By doing nothing more than what you plan to do, but doing it the right way. No one's saying you have to be the next great rabbi, although I hope there will be some great rabbis. And no one's saying you have to be the next great Herzl, though there may be some great Herzls here. It doesn't have to be cast as revolutionary. It's simply creating those fixtures to which people bond their religious affiliation that unfortunately are so scarce. Could you imagine if over the last 17 years you had walked into shul and there were 40 people in your shul davening attentively, and there were 20 people every Sunday morning sitting and learning quietly, but with pious devotion. People, not just those black hat bearded rabbis that you saw in the other room or in the other building that you were able to dismiss ideologically because they were different from you, but people in your community, people like you, let's say with a kippah struga, or people dressed in jeans, or people dressed in polo shirts. How few figures and role models like that did you have? And how different will your world be, or would it have been if you had more? And as with everything else, well, this will end. Well, if you see a fractured world, don't wait for someone else to repair it. That is a very, very mediocre and pathetic road to walk down. If you see a problem in this world, please get up and make a difference. Don't walk away and let someone else clean up that mess. Let's stop here.